This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. We continue to cover the events in Boston and around Boston, where there is still a search going on. This search has lasted for hours. We believe authorities are searching for one of the two suspects in the Boston Marathon bombing. Another suspect was killed overnight in a shootout. All morning long, the residents of Boston and surrounding communities were told to stay in their homes. It was an order that authorities were referring to as shelter in place. People were told not to open their doors unless they saw a clearly identified police officer. We have just been told by our colleague Jeff Brady in Boston that that order has been relaxed, not fully, just slightly. People are now being told if they are at somewhere like their office or have been locked down in a shopping center, you are able to now go from point A to point B. There are taxis operating. It's a good day to be a taxi driver because no other public transportation is operating in the Boston area. It has just been, Steve, an extraordinary morning, one I can't remember any morning like this.
An astounding end to an astounding week. And with that backdrop, let's go back to Boston. Bruce Gellerman is there. He's a reporter for our member station WBUR. I'm told he's a resident of Watertown. Mr. Gellerman, what a day for your, what a night and a day for your city.
Yeah, I just got home and from the office, working late on story for today, and got a call at about 1 o'clock from my editor saying, you know, right in your neighborhood is a firefight, get going. So I did, and it's about a mile from my house, and I got there, but I couldn't get more than two or three blocks to where the scene was. I was told to shut off my phone because they were afraid that it might trigger off an IED. They kept on moving the blockades from block to block, and I kept on kind of weaving through. I spoke to a number of residents of the area where there was the firefight. It went on for about 15 minutes, and It's according to them, it sounded very intense. It had punctuated by three large explosions. Then the police came to try to collect forensic evidence from it. Then they set up a reporter station here. There's two malls next to each other. And this place looks like an armed camp with a multimedia contingency.
And, of course, that shelter-in-place order has been relaxed somewhat, which means that people who are stuck at work can get home. But I would imagine the streets are still pretty much empty except for police and the occasional reporter.
Pretty much empty. I'm just starting to see some traffic now. I mean, I wasn't allowed to leave here for the last 12 hours or so. So, yeah, but it's extraordinary, the idea that you could not just shut down the streets and traffic, but every business. There's no business today.
And let's remember, when you were talking about people who witnessed a shootout there in Watertown, Massachusetts, and people described hearing three large explosions, that is consistent with what we have heard from authorities, because these young men, as they were being chased, age 19 and 26, were believed to have in some manner deployed a number of explosive devices used in their defense, along with a large number of gunshots. Our colleague Tom Gelton is with us as well, along with NPR's Dina Temple-Rest. And let me ask whichever of you feels more comfortable talking about it. In addition to these explosive devices that apparently were detonated by the young men, which Bruce Gellerman's witnesses heard, there were more explosives on the one man who was shot and killed. Correct, Tom?
You know, one of the most interesting sources of information on this whole episode was a young man who was watching it out the window of his apartment, and it was happening right in the street below him. And he said that he actually saw one of the men throw a pressure cooker type bomb. He said that he ignited it and threw it in the street. So, and he also said he saw him throw what appeared to be hand grenades. This is in addition to what was tossed out the window of the car as they were moving.
I want to make sure I underline what you just said, because you said a pressure cooker type bomb. We do have a description from the day of the Boston Marathon bombing that one of the devices was made with a pressure cooker. That's what you're talking about. And so this witness, we don't know if the witness knew what he's talking about.
That's it. We don't. It's just, it was interesting. He was in the middle of the night, and as I say, his apartment was right over the spot in the street where this conversation took place. In fact, at one point, he was on Skype, and he turned his computer and shot it out the window so that you could actually see what he was talking about. And indeed, there was all this activity right in the street below him.
Another amazing indication of the power of social media and the role it's playing in finding out what happened and even investigating this story.
And Tom Gelton, Dina Temple-Reston, either one of you jump in here. I remember you both talking about a very important moment in this investigation when an explosive vest was found, and that really changed the dynamic of this investigation. Why was that so important?
Well, what it was is, in fact, there was some sort of vest or IED device that was actually on the older of the two brothers, Tamerlan.
The one who's now dead.
The one who's now died. And there is some question as to whether or not there was an actual trigger on it, which would have turned it into sort of something more than just explosive strap.
It would have become then a suicide vest at that point.
If he's got
some kind of trigger. We don't know, though, you're saying.
Exactly. We don't know. It was of some description. But the other thing that was very interesting that we've heard in speaking to people is the actual doctor who treated him, who said that he had burns consistent with blast marks on his chest. So he died of very, it's unclear what he died of exactly. He was shot and was getting CPR when he was actually wheeled into the hospital. But he had these burns that were consistent with something like a vest. It's unclear why it didn't go off. Maybe it malfunctioned. Maybe, you know, we're unclear. But the vest is an important thing.
And we do know there were these other three explosive devices that went off at some point. And we do not know. One of the many things we do not know is if this young man, Tamerlan, was far enough away from them when they detonated. Using homemade explosives in a combat environment while having a firefight with police cannot be an easy thing to do.
You know, earlier today, much earlier, we've been on this story now for hours. Earlier in the day, there were some warnings from police that there may be unexploded devices left in the street. It wasn't clear that everything that was thrown out actually exploded, and there was great concern. This was one of the early reasons why the streets were emptied, is because they were afraid that there were unexploded devices left in the street.
Are they still afraid now, or do we feel like...
We haven't heard that, David, for a number of hours now.
Although we have heard that they have somewhat relaxed the shelter-in-place order. They've told people, if you're stuck at work, you can go home if you can find a way home. Let's bring another voice into our conversation now. Our White House correspondent, Ari Shapiro, has been covering this story. And Ari, what are you learning? And we do not yet have NPR's White House correspondent, Ari Shapiro, but as soon as we get him, we'll get him involved in the conversation. In the meantime, let's remember, Tom Gelton, we've been waiting. We do not know that it has happened yet, but we've been waiting for what's been called a controlled explosion in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We've been talking about all these different explosive devices. Remind us, when we say a controlled explosion, what are they talking about?
A controlled explosion is when law enforcement authorities find something suspicious. And, of course, in this post-9/11 age, we've heard so much talk about suspicious bags left. You know, we have had parts of Washington shut down when they have identified some kind of bag or box or something like that in the street.
Entire airports can be cleared.
People are told, if you see something, say something.
Yeah. And one of the things that law enforcement authorities do, if they don't have other options, is rather than get in there and sort of mess with it and risk getting blown up themselves, they'll just blow it up. So we don't know. We know that the Massachusetts police colonel, Alban, who talked about this, said it was being this controlled explosion was going to take place, quote, out of an abundance of caution. So they evidently found something in this house that they didn't like, and they decided they wanted to blow it up.
Although this is a tough one, because if you're an investigator, if you can do it safely, you'd rather preserve that device rather than blow it up or whatever it is, because it might lead you to more clues as to what happened and who did it. So we have this warning of a controlled explosion at some point in Cambridge, Massachusetts, at or near a home that has been associated with the two young men of Chechen origin who are identified as suspects in the Boston Marathon bombing. One of them dead, one of them still at large. Now we have NPR White House correspondent Ari Shapiro on the line. And Ari, what is the president and the White House staff doing? What is their role in all of this?
Hi, Steve.
Hi there, Ari. Okay,
He's been in briefings this morning, and we've been getting readouts of those briefings. Sorry, I'm just hearing a real delay on the line here.
Yes, please.
That sounds like I'm speaking a few...
I'll tell you what, Ari Shapiro, let's take Ari Shapiro out. We'll bring him back in just a moment when that technical problem has been fixed. We will continue our coverage here. We have correspondents in Boston. We have correspondents in Washington tracking the latest information. And so much of it is coming, as we have heard, on social media. We've heard that one of the accused bombers, the one who is still at large, Johar Tsarnaev, appears to have had a Twitter account that continued to be active as recently as Wednesday, which was after the bombing. Dina Temple-Rest, and while we wait to hear from Ari Shapiro, let's talk about how investigators would proceed from here. They've got a body. They've got identities. They've got countries, entire countries, to go chasing for leads. And, of course, they have whatever evidence they're gathering in Watertown and Cambridge and other places in the Boston area. What are the questions investigators would ask, and how do they proceed?
Well, they'll be trying to put together a timeline of months before the bombing and anything that had happened afterwards. And one of the things that we're trying to confirm now is it appears that the elder brother, Tamerlan, actually went to Russia and stayed there for 6 months. And we don't know what exactly he was doing there. That would be something that the FBI would be trying to figure out.
And just tell us why the timeline becomes so important. Why is that the next step that investigators really want to piece together?
What they're most concerned about now is that there are other people out there and that other attacks can happen and that there's might be in waves.
The timeline could link them to other people who might be, I mean, in theory, in the planning stages of something else.
That's right. They could have associates. There could be cell phone calls. These are all things that are very important when you're putting together.
Let's remember, this is something we don't know. We know there was at least one other person of great interest to police who was grabbed overnight and stripped to make sure that he didn't have explosives on him and bundled into a police car. So we know of one other person. And you were talking about the general notion that people who are radicalized may be part of some group, some social group, but we don't know the answers to these questions at all.
But we do know about that particular person that the FBI is still calling him a possible accomplice, and they have not let him go.
And one of the reasons that these stories can change so much as time goes on is we don't know what investigators know right now. I mean, we are getting information from them, but they're being probably so careful as they do what you just described, piecing together a timeline, as there might be other leads to follow. I mean, they have different audiences. They tell us whatever they can, we would hope, but there's probably a lot of information that they don't exactly want to pass on.
Tom Gelton.
You know, I can guarantee you that one person the authorities are very anxious to talk to, if they have not spoken to already, would be the wife of Tamerlan Tsarnaev. He married a Christian woman who my colleague Dina tells us later converted to Islam. But if she is around in the Boston area, she would know about his day-to-day attitudes, feelings, activities. That would be a very important person to talk to.
And I want to repeat again, we're mentioning the religion of these young men. At least one of them seems to have described himself as Muslim. The other had a wife who converted to Islam. We're not saying it is or is related here. We're not saying Islam is a marker of terrorism. We're saying we are collecting dots, not connecting dots at this time. Shankar Vedantam, you want it in here.
Well, I think what happens very often with these investigations, Steve, is that things jump out at us. And it's very striking when you think about what happens right after a terrorist incident. People invariably gravitate to the